No.
Sorry.
Wait a minute.
What the heck? The old switcheroo door move. Didn't see that coming. Duh. Yeah, David in the day.
Welcome back, John.
Yes, back to the land of the living. By the way, Jacob, did you move my sound over into my news boss?
I believe so.
That I sent over to you?
I'll find that for you.
I wasn't that excited to watch it again.
No,
I know you're not that excited, but that's not really about you. I need that to be able to tell my story. I have a story to tell, and I need to tell
I promised
story.
Listeners yesterday and the day before that you'd come back with lots of stories.
By the way, I went and got a physical today. I've lost an inch. That's how messed up I was. I need a sponsor for that.
Lift.
You can
get lifts for your feet.
Not my height. All right, Hannah, what's going on?
Hello?
Jacob's like, should we drop that? Okay, hey, Hannah. You got a chance. Is this an exclusive that you got?
I think some other folks have talked to him when it first came out a couple of weeks ago that he was going to be leaving. But, I had a longer talk probably with him.
Okay. All right. You don't need to brag, but this will brag for you. So the police chief in Bellevue decides to leave after how long he had been there? Like 8 years or something?
Six years. They scooped him up out of Corpus Christi, Texas. And he's honestly, it's a big loss. He's moving on to Akron, Ohio to be a police chief there. This is Steve Milette, the police chief in Bellevue. Today is his last day. He moved on. He said it doesn't have anything to do with new police laws, controversy, protests, anything like that. It's a family thing. He wants to be somewhere where his children and his grandchildren and everyone can thrive and live close, kind of together. And he said, unfortunately, this is a very expensive place to live, and it's not a great place for his kids to thrive. So that's part of the reason that he's moving on. Yes, but he's had a really just fabulous career here. He's done quite a bit to be remembered, and he's definitely leaving Bellevue PD in a better state than when he found it. And here's what he has to say about his folks.
I am so proud of the men and women that I get to interact with here in the police department every single day. We're not perfect, but the heart of the police officers in the city of Bellevue is noble, and they come out to serve the public every single day with a selfless attitude and looking to help people. And the culture that's within this police department, I'd put it up against any other. I would. Now, again, we're not perfect. And yes, we are going to have that employee, hopefully on rare occasion, do something that they shouldn't do. And then we'll deal with it and we'll hold them accountable. But the men and women of this police department, sworn and civilian, contributes to making this place very special.
So I mentioned he is leaving Bellevue PD in a better state than when he found it. When he got here, there was some misconduct concerns and things like that going on. And he came right in and almost immediately in that first year made some significant changes, including outreach, creating these various kind of communicating with community, if you will, created a bunch of advisory committees to interact with the police chief and the leadership at the police department to make sure everybody knows what's going on with their police. And he created what's known as the Tomorrow's Program.
The signature program that we developed early on when I got here and continues to thrive in this police department is the Tomorrow's Program, where we look at community engagement as our opportunity and our responsibility to effectively serve the people that we're sworn to serve. Looking for every opportunity to engage with the community. And, you know, we created the sector captain program, the 7 advisory councils to the chief of police, working with community leaders, coming up with town hall forums and safety forums, everything that we've done to keep the community informed on what their police department is doing.
The other part of that program.
Looking for every opportunity to strengthen our systems of service here in the police department, working to ensure that we're furthering the vision of the city council and the work of the city manager and the rest of the city team. And again, there's multiple things that I can point to as components of that. And then the last pillar is employee engagement, employee wellness, and employee development. Because if you don't invest in ensuring that you have healthy employees, and I'm talking physical well-being, mental well-being, emotional well-being.
Then he says you don't succeed and they don't thrive and that kind of thing. Now, he has had some interesting moments in his career. I asked him what he was proudest of. That was that Tomorrow's program. His biggest regret, he said, was not being able to solve the disappearance of Sky Metawalla. That was the 5-year-old boy who many years ago, the mom said she ran out of gas, left him in the car and walked away. And but she had dual passports. She was international, and she would just never cooperate. Mm-hmm. And they've never been able to locate him. And he said he's got a picture of the boy on his desk, and he'll always have that. And that's his biggest regret. Now, one of the things that he got a lot of attention for came last year at the height of the protest, the beginning of the protest, actually, on May 31st, as the Seattle downtown area was being kind of torn apart. There was this coordinated effort of looters and rioters that went and just converged on Bellevue, on the malls and things down there, that was really extreme. Mm-hmm. And there was other groups there, though, because it was, again, you had multiple groups of protesters. They were angry, and he sat, and you saw him on the news. The choppers got him, I think. He sat and he talked with these folks.
I have found, Hannah, over the last 32 years, that when you have two groups like this, there is usually more in common with each other than what appears to be. Police officers want systems that are in place that serve everybody equally and fairly. They do not want to be dragged into situations where they are perceived to be discriminating against anybody. And, of course, the people in our communities want to be heard. They want to be treated fairly. They want to have confidence that the systems that impact them are going to treat them equally. And at least here in the city of Bellevue and the police department that I have the privilege of leading, we all are on the same page with that.
And that's really his approach to everything. He is a very gracious man. He's well-respected by his officers at the Bellevue Police Department. You know, I first started to talk with him several years ago after there was a sexual misconduct or harassment case against him by a woman who turned out it didn't know him, had never met him. It was a whole thing. I had done some research and found his phone number, and he answered, and we talked, and he handled that situation with such grace in a situation that could have been, I have to imagine, the most frustrating thing that one could go through. He really handled that with grace, and he's done that with everything and has been seen as a leader as we talk about the reimagining of public safety and policing and all of that, which he's a big supporter of. He believes that policing needs to evolve consistently, and especially the end of systemic racism and all of that. But he did also voice concerns with me about the new policing laws we have in this state, mostly that perhaps they were a bit rushed. And it's going to be a challenge for the officers who are now uncertain when they're out on the streets.
I had a chance to meet him. I think he'd only been on the job for a couple of weeks. And he gave a speech to a group of businessmen and women in Bellevue. There are police officers there as well. He's the kind of guy, Tom, you meet him and within 1 minute, you're like, what a decent human being.
Right?
He has such a calm demeanor, but such behind it is such an authority of just a straight shooter that you can't help but to like him immediately. And didn't feel phony about him. I remember talking to a Bellevue cop a couple years later. I'd mentioned, hey, I was there at that breakfast. Oh, yeah, I remember meeting there. I said, how's my life working out? Great guy. Everybody loves him because he's a real deal. He walks the walk, talks the talk, real deal. So it's nice to be able to leave on a sort of an up note. He's going to Akron. Akron is not exactly a Bellevue. Looking online, they have about 52 murders. I'm looking at Bellevue, homicides in Bellevue. So let's see, 21, 22. Looks like you got, one?
Not a lot. But he's thinking that some of what he's learned here, and not necessarily the murder rate in Bellevue, but the other skills as far as interacting with community, he's a very big proponent of that, of interacting and doing these meetings constantly with the community and the various, you know, your communities of color and all of that kind of thing, that can help really kind of improve dialogue and help in that situation in Akron. He thought that he would be beneficial in that way.
24% poverty rate in Akron.
Oof.
Good God. Isn't that where LeBron James is from?
I'm not sure.
I think he is from Akron.
Ohio. Yeah. I think, Akron.
Yeah, but that's going to be, that will be quite the change for our chief. Yeah.
Definitely. So, he's an East Coast guy, though, too. So he's got family over there and is closer.
Getting closer. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, so listen, I've got lots of questions. I'm just wondering, given his persona, the way he manifests, you know, his opinions, the way he kind of, I don't know what, it's not this sort of aggressive, gruff, you know, for want of a better word, East Coast kind of, you know, tough guy approach. Do you think, and again, not that this is in the realm of possibility anymore, but do you think that his style, and perhaps specifically him, that he would have been a good Seattle police chief?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I'm going to tell you my honest, this is my opinion. I'm just going to throw it out right now that my opinion.
Opinion alert on the show.
I'm just going to kind of set it up that way. I don't do it all the time.
Here we go.
This police chief and the Seattle police officer who lost her life on I-5 not too many months ago, those are two of the most inspirational law enforcement people I have met in my entire career as a reporter, who I think could make a significant difference in what we see in Seattle.
Yeah, that's something. And was there much pushback? I remember, I think that some people, I don't want to accuse anybody because I don't remember specifically, but when he made this gesture, wasn't he like kneeling down with the protesters or something? That there was some...
Me.
Blowback.
Yeah, I think it was John, actually.
It was. I was standing out in front of Nordstrom when the people broke the window and were throwing clothes and pants and shoes out onto
extreme.
The sidewalk.
It was, yeah.
And then other groups would show up with their cars and park their cars there, and then they would throw more clothes and more jewelry, and they wiped out Nordstrom's first floor. Then they went up to the second floor and then threw all the stuff out that window. I remember watching all of that, and about the same time, we were getting a wonderful gesture of kneeling with people. I understand there were different groups there. I stood there and was yelled at by a bunch of knuckleheads. But standing there and watching, obviously the police, there's no way they could have stopped it. I mean, this was organized. This was a peaceful protest. It was an opportunity to steal something. So they did. And there's no way they could possibly have enough cops to be able to stop all the theft that was going on. Plus, the riots were happening on the street. So where the chief was, he ended up meeting with those people. And, you know, but I pointed out
different.
That... It was mayhem in Bellevue for a good long time.
But let's remember, too, he circled back, and he went, those people who busted into the Bellevue Mall just to steal stuff, he got them, and they were prosecuted.
Yes.
Yeah, how
the
about
point,
that?
Though,
Bellevue,
John,
way to go. Yeah.
Was that his approach to the protesters? I know you think that every protester is a hooligan, but the people that he was dealing with were not the ones going that you were witnessing. It was not really cross town,
yeah,
but in a different arena. Okay. So, but there was pushback. And again, I wasn't trying to call you out, John. I just remember that it was a gesture of weakness. What kind of idealistic, you know, boob thinks this? I mean, this is, you know, why are we approaching that? He clearly, maybe it's because he's on his way out that everyone is, you know, the encomiums cannot stop coming. Was there much resistance within the police force? Because the one thing we hear about Seattle Police Department a lot is that there's often a clash between the leadership and the cop on the beat. The leadership always has to play politics. Was there much pushback from the Bellevue cops on the street, so to speak, to this kind of what some would see from the right, at least, as a gesture of weakness?
No, not to my knowledge. Really? And I'll tell you, there was a couple of times that he's had to discipline some officers, but for the most part, the Bellevue police are really, they can be held up as really a really solid example, and not a lot of pushback and a lot of love for him. I'm going to tell you, I ran this story on Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross today.
What? Wait, whoa, and, whoa,
no,
whoa,
listen,
whoa,
listen.
Whoa.
That's worse than having an opinion.
Go ahead.
But right afterwards, yeah. I got an email from someone who works for Chief Mylett, who thanked me and said that they loved the story. It made them very sad because it captured the epitome of how they feel about this man and this leader and the sadness that they have for him leaving. So he's very, very well respected. And okay. Yeah. Not a lot of that. And he really did. I want to point this out, too, because I've talked about this on the air, about the pink umbrella incident in Seattle police and how those protest organizers were trying on that day to interact with the police and have conversation and kind of get what we saw with Chief Mylett. And they didn't. And then, of course, you know, everything got all chaotic. And he said to me, you can't compare the two things. What Seattle police were dealing with for days and days by that point was so very different. And just not the same situation. But in his experience, being able to provide that ear and listen to those folks, the protesters, about their concerns, then in turn, they were able to listen to what he had to say and hear his perspective, and it went well.
The point I made, I'll make it again, is when you kneel, you're basically saying, yes, we have common cause. I agree with you. Police brutality is a problem. And that is not. Because you can statistically see where police were and how they handled people 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and the work that's being done. It is not what you hear in mainstream media, that the police are out there beating people up randomly every single day, stopping black people more than white people, all of the nonsense. It goes over and over again. When you kneel, you're basically saying, I hear you. We've got a real problem with this police brutality. Again, no one has ever found one fact that has said that George Floyd was killed because of the color of his skin.
We're not going to get to the next story. We can do it tomorrow. But I want to leave you with a nugget that just came out. I just tweeted
Here's
it.
Here's a nugget.
This is about Seattle police. The Neighborhood Grocers, the Food Industry Association, is put out a formal request for the city of Seattle to return to a basic level of law enforcement staffing because they need adequate response times and a maintaining of public safety.
Good. And Hannah, by the way, I'm going to send you a text. I got this from somebody. I don't know if it's true. I don't want to say it on the air yet, but I'll give you a chance to check this out. Because if this is true, this is going to be a little bit of a problem.
Okay. I'll check it out.
All right. Send it over to you. All right. Tracy Taylor, go look at traffic for us. There we go. Kiel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Thank you, Laura Kiel. Thanks for making sure that everybody feels as if you and they are combined together with one single goal. That's to make sure the process to get that mortgage is as easy as can be. It's Kiel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Kevin Williamson, big fan of his. I've read a couple of books by him. I love the fact that he worked at Atlantic for about 6 weeks. No, 6 hours. And then they ran him out on a rail. He has an interesting piece. It must be in the National Review, right? He does occasionally.
Yes.
The American right hits its hippie phase. He basically lays out that you sort of look at how America was with politics. I guess he takes you back to the hippies and what they were revolting against. And then he takes you through the 70s and the 80s and sort of skips over some other stuff. But basically saying, now look at this. The right is now similar to, although they don't have long hair and tie-dye, they're sort of attacking the establishment the same way hippies attacked the establishment in the 60s.
I love this because he has a thesis, and then he goes about and tries to demonstrate the thesis. Now, I don't think it's airtight, like a lot of theses, but I love the intellectual adventuresome of what he's doing. It's a daring proposal, and he makes this distinction. I remember studying this when I was in college. It's the difference between the Apollonian and the Dionysian. The Apollonian, they represent two sides of humanity. The Apollonian is the rational, the orderly, the calm, thoughtful approach, and the Dionysian is the wild kind of ecstatic, emotional response. Yeah. And he says that obviously both aspects have their good sides. And when it is applied to politics, he says in the 60s, the Democrats align themselves with what he calls the hippie movement. But basically, they were anti-establishment. If you remember, and people, I realize half the audience doesn't remember the 60s. But the 60s
Hippies were anti-establishment. The Democrats were racists.
Okay, John, I don't know where you're going with that, but the
no, just pointing it out, Tom. The Democrats,
civil
were Southern
rights
Democrats
happened.
Were
Southern Democrats were not all the Democrats. Most okay. of the Democrats, the Democratic Party was not about racism.
Uh-huh.
At that point, it was a Southern strategy of Richard Nixon in 1968 yeah. that actually switched the racists to the Republican
the hippies
side.
Hippies were anti-establishment.
But we're getting off the point.
Hippies were anti-establishment everything. They didn't want
That's
to work
right.
with the government at all. And the Democrats were still sort of doing what the Democrats did in the 60s.
Okay.
And the Republicans did what they did. But the outside of that were the hippies. I didn't think the hippies were trying to do anything with the government. And
okay, well, so
do you think the Democratic Party was reaching out to the hippies in the 60s?
They were certainly, well, the thing is, the hippies, if and again, we're using this in the loosest of terms,
yeah.
but the hippies were the ones that ended up scuttling poor Hubert Humphrey's chances at the presidency because of what happened in the Chicago Convention. So they went beyond that. But in general, if you had to divide the parties,
oh, yeah.
the anti-war people were more Democrats than Republicans. So
yes.
what his point was that at the time, the 60s radicals were against they were against any kind of big government. They were against business establishment. They were against, as he says, organized religion. They just held in disdain all of these major institutions, and that also meant that if you compromised or you were moderate or you cooperated with the opposing side, that you were suspect. The weird thing now, he says, is that over the last 50 years, what's happened is now the Republicans are embracing that kind of anti-establishment approach, and the Democrats are the ones that are saying, stick with the science, and they're appealing to the scientific community and all of that, that he says the roles have completely reversed. So right now, what the right has are a bunch of, he thinks, kind of, what he calls them literally, absurd mask politics, election trutherism, anti-vaccine activism, 1,001 conspiracies, and QAnon. He says now the Republicans are the ones that are acting, nonsensical. They're acting with beyond reason and all. And he says how things have really flipped. The reason he's most concerned, because he's a good conservative, he says the Dionysian movements do not jive well with conservative principles. Mm-hmm. Conservatives are about, conservatism is about saving what is good in what we have, not overturning, everything in a kind of anarchic impulse because you're mad at how things are going. Mm-hmm. And he says at some point, conservatives and or the Republican Party are going to have to come back to its senses, because he clearly, if he was leaning one way or another, and if you, and I love Kevin Williamson's writing because it's so well educated.
Yeah.
He's clearly Apollonian more than he is Dionysian, and that's an interesting angle that he presents here.
Yeah, well, I'll say that the 60s were torn apart by the Vietnam War. The hippies didn't want to fight, and they were into tuning in and tune out, right, and drop out, and anything
yeah.
having to do with money or anything else. And most of the people that were leading that charge, according to Kevin Williamson and according to facts, were rich kids with silver spoons in their mouth. I like the list of people that were – I didn't know William Burroughs came from Burroughs adding machines, and I didn't
yeah.
realize that Squeaky Fromm, who she was, and these people that were so elite, so rich, could then talk to other people about dropping out. So the 60s tore apart the country, not only race relations, but then also the war took people out of it. But the idea right now, what you have, I believe, is not true conservatism or liberalism or even the true liberalism like the 1920s, but the idea of populism. So populism can only
yes.
have the shortest fuse of anything. It only lasts as long as somebody is screaming and yelling about something. There is no necessarily forward progress in populism. Populism that takes over a country and then takes over, it doesn't build, it only destroys, and then it sits there and finds something else to get mad about. And that's what we experienced. Donald Trump came in, right, Tom? We talked about this before. He's the bull in the China shop. If you want to destroy
right.
all the China, fine.
Yes.
Now what are you going to do?
He's a Dionysian figure, Donald
right.
Trump is.
Now
yes.
what do you want to do? You destroyed
yeah.
all the China. Are we in the business of selling Chinese China? Well, then we have no China to sell. So what's the system that's going to be in place? You're going to tear everything down and build it back up again in what image? A quote from the Bible, the idea of the temple in 3 days. So, it's an interesting piece, but I don't know if the Republican Party or those that are libertarian will see. Is that really the future, the QAnon people? I don't think so. And I don't think that people, the Democrats that are in there now, are necessarily mainstream. Do you really believe that's mainstream, the stuff they're pushing, Tom?
Well, in terms of his arguments, it is appeal to authority. So right now, it
power.
Used to be that the liberals were, you know, shaking their fists at the establishment and Richard Nixon and the military and all that. And now it's the Republicans who don't trust. Basically, the pitch from Trump onward has been don't trust authority. Don't trust the elite class. Don't trust any of these so-called experts. So it really has, the roles have reversed. Now, there are all sorts, you can start taking pot shots about things. I'm not sure that the Manson family is the culmination of the hippie movement, but it's an argument that he's making. I think it's an interesting way to look at things, that right now a lot of the old-fashioned Republicans, the traditional Republicans, are scratching their heads saying, what has happened to my party? Some people in the party are embracing Trump, and others are just trying to figure out what the heck happened. I think what happened was the Dionysian element on the right, like the Tea Party and all that, finally has come to a head. And yeah, the question, and he ends it that way, how long is this going to last? And he says, your guess is as good as mine. He said it was just the day before yesterday. Yeah, he sends it. But if there were such a thing as stuck in cults, I'd be long on those and short on most of what we understand today to be conservatism until the day before yesterday. So he's assuming that conservatism as it existed 2 days ago is going to be end up trumping the Dionysian moment that Republicans are going through right now.
I would say that not much has changed. I'm looking so William F. Buckley, the sort of grandfather of conservatism, wrote the book God and Man at Yale.
Yeah.
And it was recognized by Time magazine as one of the top 100 best and most influential books. So, and that was in the 1952, talking about what the people were teaching students at Yale back then. Now they're doing the same thing again, or they have never stopped teaching what they want to teach there. And he was saying that you need to stop this and influence young
people. He'd be rolling over in his grave about Trump, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, he would never.
Yeah, okay. No, that's, yeah.
And you wouldn't be able to call yourself a conservative. He would have stopped that sort of thing. All right. Well, listen, it's a great piece, and he has a lot of really smart stuff to say, and he's got great books as well. So Kevin Williamson, the man to look for. Not good for Atlantic. They ran him out on a rail very quickly.
I know. I can't remember what that was about. But
It was because he is against abortion, and he thinks that if you have an abortion, you should possibly be brought up on murder.
And he expressed that in a call. I mean, the point of hiring Kevin Williamson is because he's a...
No, not when the left's
in charge. Smart.
I know, but you can't have that.
I'm part of the left, and I'm telling you that.
Well, you're not part of the new left, Tom. You're not part of the new left. You got to get in step with the new left.
I'm too old for the new.
You got to start burning books, baby. All right, Tracy Taylor, good traffic for us. Sad day, Tom.
What's that?
The hucksters around the world. He would be able to cut a tomato so thin it only had one side, Tom.
That's the kind of line that would make you famous almost as much as Ron Popeil.
Ron Popeil passes away, or he's on back order. What is the, let's see.
Wait, there's more.
Operators are standing by. If you don't know who Ron Popeil was, for the longest time, he was the sort of early guy to infomercials, and you could watch, and you'd be... mesmerized by his excitement and enthusiasm and the magic of whatever he was selling.
GLH means great looking hair. Just spray GLH on and it instantly covers your bald spot, leaving you with great looking hair. And ladies with thinning hair or bald spots, GLH solves the problem instantly. GLH is not a paint or a cover-up.
No.
It's an amazing powder that clings to the tiniest hairs on your head. It actually builds on itself, leaving you with great looking hair. And the GLH hair system is not expensive.
It's a system, Tom. It's not a can.
But not like FEUE, though.
No. Don't even put this in a gag. This is a can of spray paint.
Wow. That's incredible. This is the first time I've ever used this product. I saw it on the infomercials, and I was skeptical at first.
Okay, he's sold. How about this one? This I never understood why anybody would need to instantly fish.
It's back. The Popeil Pocket Fisherman.
I caught a 3-pound trout with it. Wow!
I got one for Christmas, and it's really cool.
I just caught these with my Pocket Fisherman.
It's the fishing invention of the century.
Of the century.
There's never been anything like it. It's both.
No, there has never been anything like it. Jacob, it was a fishing rod that was very tiny, no more than like 8 or 9 inches, and it would fold up and fold in, put it in your pocket because you'd be driving along and be, hold on,
Hang on. I'll catch a fish.
A Fields Pocket Fisherman. So small it fits in your glove compartment.
Yes.
Backpack. Even your pocket. And the Pocket Fisherman's handle is its own mini tackle box. Casting is so easy with the Popiel Pocket Fisherman.
By the way, if you did catch a fish with your Pocket Fisherman, now where does your fish fit? In the glove compartment? In your pocket? In your backpack? You've caught the fish, now what?
And boy, you can catch all kinds of great fighting fish.
Yeah. Call now and get two Pocket Fishermen for the price of one. That's right, for a limited time, you get two Pocket Fishermen for only $29.95 plus S&H.
By the way, shipping and handling on that stuff is ridiculous because I tried to buy this baby.
Hey, this Christmas party is getting a little too quiet. I think it's time we liven it up with my favorite Christmas gift.
This is actually, that's sound from Dave Ross from a couple of years ago at a Cairo party.
Mr. Microphone.
Hey, what's that?
Well, you set the dial on your FM radio and testing.
I'm on the radio.
I'm going to go fishing.
These kids are having a fabulous time with Mr. Microphone, the cordless microphone that actually puts your voice on the radio. There are no attaching wires, so you're free to move around. Broadcast over any FM car radio.
Hey, good looking. We'll be back to pick you up later.
By the way, that is now illegal. You're not allowed to yell that kind of stuff out your car door window. He was in a convertible at the time while driving with the Pocket Fisherman and the hairspray all in his hair. What took Ron Popeil from us, Tom?
I didn't see that. He was 86. I assume it was just, nothing announced at least. The amazing thing about him, you know, you're a great pitch man, John, but you don't invent the product that you're pitching.
Yes.
You didn't invent the FUE treatment.
No, I wish I did. I wouldn't be on the radio right now because it is the most advanced and it works.
But he actually did all those things. He was in. He was like an inventor who was also a pitchman. That's what made him so remarkable.
Yeah, he really believed it.
Yeah, which helps when you're selling stuff like
that. Well,
I mean,
the thing is, it's like the money-back guarantee on that. That was the thing. Like, operators are standing by now. And then they'd flash the phone number at the bottom of the screen. I remember sitting there watching that thing, especially when they'd spray that paint on the head. And then somebody used to call up and say that Larry King used to use it all the time, too.
Using what?
Spray paint his bald spot.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. It's not a paint, John. It attaches to little teeny tiny hair molecules and covers it up.
Actually, you know what? Ron Popeil came to Seattle, and we did a story on him for Evening Magazine, and he went around and sprayed people's heads with that thing.
Did you? That was before you were. That was pre bald spot for you, right?
Yes, Tom.
Or did he?
Yes.
Did he try?
No, I didn't have a bald spot then, but I got mine taken. Don't try to drag Ron Popeil and the hair in a can anywhere near advanced hair. Okay, the separate, completely, absolutely. Don't even do that, Tom.
Advanced hair in a can doesn't exist.
No.
My dad used that for a long time.
Wow.
There
you go.
How about the pocket fisherman?
No, well, no, but my husband got one of those as a white elephant Christmas gift.
Oh, good. Yeah.
That's good.
But the hair in the can my dad used for years.